Welcome to the GRF On The Go podcast. The subject matter experts at GRF CPAs and Advisors created this podcast to offer insights on current topics, as well as new ideas and best practices that your team can apply today. This podcast was originally presented as a live webinar. CPE information provided during the podcast is no longer valid, but if you're interested in watching the video version of this session or accessing the slide deck, visit our website at grfcpa.com/events. Enjoy the episode and remember to subscribe for future content.
Hello, everyone. I want to welcome you all participating in today's webinar, Maximizing Operating Reserves, Best Practices for Trade and Professional Associations. My name is Yevgeny Sahenko. I'm a partner in our Outsourced Accounting and Advisory Services Department here at GRF. And today I'm joined by my colleagues, John Pace, Melissa Musser, Susan Colliday, and Trisha Cadavini. We also have a very special guest with us from the National Sand, Stone, and Gravel Association, Michael Johnson, who has graciously offered his time to participate in our fireside chat segment at the end of the presentation. So absolutely be sure to stick around for that. So the five of us between us have a wealth of experience and knowledge in dealing with operating reserves, and we're happy to share our experiences and our knowledge and hopefully present to you some exciting content. So some quick housekeeping items. Anyone that's seeking CPE credit today will be required to complete and submit a short survey that will appear automatically following our webinar. To obtain the CPE, please participate in each of our polling questions throughout the session, as that will be how we will gauge your active participation. Please also note that this webinar is not intended as financial or legal advice. This is simply for educational purposes. So with that, again, we're GRF CPAs and Advisors. We're based out of Bethesda, Maryland, but we serve clients in the DMV area and honestly, nationally and internationally. We have a wide range of clients covering not-for-profit, for-profit schools, government contractors, and others, but our particular niche is within the not-for-profit and INGO space. We've been in operation for several decades, and in 2021, we actually celebrated our 40-year anniversary. So without further ado, as you can see, we have a lot to cover today, so let's just get right into it.
So I'm going to pick up with my slides. I'm going to move us forward a little bit. Hey, folks, Susan Colliday here. I'm an audit partner in GRF. While I'm moving the slides forward, it's nice to be with you all, and thank you for joining us. So my section of the slides goes over, it kind of builds on what Melissa was going to talk about. Melissa was going to talk about enterprise risk management and all of those concepts in ERM. My section talks about how to use ERM to determine a reserve amount. And my polling question is, does your organization have a written reserves policy approved by the board? Simple yes or no, unsure kind of answers here. Let's see what everybody has out there. We'll wait for the poll to come in a little bit. Good stuff. A lot of people have a reserve policy. That's great. So let's talk about how to determine the amount that should be in reserves. Maybe your reserve policy is based on a simple kind of benchmarking process or what have you. But let's talk about how to make it unique to your organization. So targeting reserves using ERM. So this concept is basically walking through your risk assessment process and also using your strategic plan to then build a defensible reserves target. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you have a large amount in reserves, do your members or your board of directors ask you why you're sitting on so much cash? So how do you develop that defensible reserves target? So why do you need those reserves? So ERM is a way that you can determine your reserves target. And so we'll walk you through that, and then you can weave that into your written policy. All right. So before we get into that, let's level set for the discussion. So In the purposes of this part of the slides, let's talk about what do we mean by reserves. In this particular scenario that we're talking about, we are talking about net assets, that part of your balance sheet that's kind of your net assets without donor restrictions. So your net assets with donor restrictions, you can't really set anything aside there because you have to use those donor restricted net assets for a particular purpose or a particular time. But your net assets without donor restrictions, your board can set aside a portion of those net assets to use as a reserve fund. And then once you have that reserve fund set aside, your next step is to weave that into your investment policy and talk about how are you going to invest that number, that target for reserves. Do you want it to be really liquid? Do you want it to be held in more long-term assets and that kind of thing? So there really are two policies that work together when you have a reserves target. It's the reserves policy where your board does a motion to designate a portion of your net assets without donor restrictions and set up the reserve. But then there's also the investment policy that addresses how the organization is going to invest those reserve assets. And it might be commingled with your regular operating investments, or it might be set aside in a separate account, or it might need to be really liquid for whatever reason. So that's kind of what the level set I wanted to make sure we understood. The other piece of this level set is a lot of people think about benchmarking for determining their reserves. And in other words, looking at what other organizations are doing. I caution you on that because benchmarking doesn't always give you the right number for your organization. It's more of a way to go, okay, let's see if we're in line with other organizations, but not use benchmarking to necessarily determine what number is right for your organization. And where can you get that benchmarking? There's a couple of places. ASAE, the American Society of Association Executives, puts out an operating ratio report that it tracks reserves, and it does it by organization size. Another way to get it is if you have access to the CauseIQ database, which farms 990 data. You can get reserves information from 990 data, and you can also kind of use that database to narrow it down to certain target organizations that are similar in size or similar in what activities they carry out. So those are some ideas of where you can get benchmarking, but I guess where we're going to go here today is to try to figure out or show you how to develop your own reserve target that's unique to your organization. All right, let me move on. Let's see. All right, so the first step to developing your particular number for your reserve target is to look at your risks and opportunities. And this is where the ERM element of this comes into play, is if you're doing an enterprise risk management process, you're going to have a list of risks that are particular to your organization. You're going to have a list of opportunities that your organization might want to pursue. And how are those risks and opportunities woven into your target for your reserve number? So once you've developed that list of risks and opportunities, you need to rank those, we'll call them events, in some way. A lot of people use a heat map to do that ranking. And I'll show you some examples of heat maps in just a second. And then once you've determined the ranking of your risks and opportunities, then you narrow that list down to which ones are the most significant that, you know, might have the most impact on your organization's net assets. And then once you have that list, you have to obtain agreement among the stakeholders of which events require a response. And that is a step that, and Melissa will tell you this, that is a step that a lot of organizations struggle with is, you know, management might think the risks are here, the board might think they're here, and then you've got to kind of get everybody to come into alignment on what are the most important risks and opportunities that need to be addressed in your reserve target calculation. So then you determine the response to those events, and that's also part of your ERM process. So that's why Melissa was going to go first, so that we could kind of get that basic background. I'm having trouble moving the slides for some reason. There we go. Oh, it was delayed. Sorry, guys. All right, here we go. Examples of heat maps. So there's a couple ways you can rank your risks and opportunities. You can put them in a heat map. You could just list them out in an Excel schedule, although I think a visual is a much better way to rank risks and opportunities. So these are just examples of what you could use from a heat map perspective. You know, you have usually it's impact and likelihood or probability along the other axis, and then you're heat mapping so that upper right-hand quadrant in the heat map on the more colorful side, that's where you're going to be focused on those risks, because those are the ones that are going to have the most probability of happening and have the highest impact on your financial statements. So that's where I would suggest focusing. You don't want to have to develop a reserves target for every single risk in your list, because you might never have enough reserves for dealing with all of the risks that could be out there. And that's where you get into, okay, looking at the risk response. And again, the slides are delayed. So I'm trying to move the slides forward. We did practice this. That's the slide I need. If that was Nathan, thank you. All right. So then once you've got your list of risks and you've situated that, you need to determine, okay, what are the risks we're going to deal with and how are we going to respond to them? The list on the right there, reduce, mitigate, eliminate, avoid, that's risks. The list on the right in orange, averse, cautious, those would be your opportunities. And I'm making a distinction between a risk and an opportunity. So, you know, for example, with a risk, if there's a risk that's so big that you want to reduce it or mitigate it or eliminate it or avoid it, you're basically removing that from your list of risks that you're going to include in your reserve target calculation, because you don't want to deal with that risk at all. And transferring risk is where you're going to have an insurance policy that's going to cover that situation if it were to happen. Cybersecurity is an example, if you have the ability to get insured for cybersecurity. Then if you're going to accept a risk or exploit a risk, those are the risks where you're going to want to include those in your reserve target calculation. So there's a couple of different ways, once you have your list of risks, there's a couple of different ways to respond to those risks. The graphic in the middle of this slide kind of gives you an overview of sort of the ERM process, where you're doing the risk identification, the risk assessment, and the risk response. So then once you've figured out those kind of three elements, then you can kind of go into, well, what are we going to do with those risks that we're going to respond to? And same thing with opportunities. I think it's important to call these events rather than just risks, because opportunities sometimes will also require use of reserves. So for example, if you have a new program that you want to launch for your members, and you don't want to charge your members a fee for it, you're going to use reserves to launch the program, but then you're going to eventually need to price that and charge a fee for it. But the cost to launch the program might need to come from reserves. And another example of that, an opportunity would be the opportunity to improve your technology. So that would be risks and opportunities and how we're going to deal with them. So I'm trying to move my slides again, Nathan. I think I'm going to give up on that and let Nathan just move my slides for me. So here's an example of a calculation for reserves. Now, this is a very broad example, and I was trying to kind of just come up with some examples of what you would maybe include in your reserves calculation. And again, this is after you've gone through the process of listing out your risks and opportunities and determining which ones are, the high ones that you want to deal with, getting that stakeholder buy-in on which ones are the big ones to deal with, and then determining the risk response. And now we're at that stage where we've determined that the ones we need to set aside some reserves for is this final list. And so then you go through and you're going to estimate a lot of this stuff. And this is where this is almost like budgeting in a way. And I know a lot of accountants don't like this squishy kind of thing where we're guesstimating, but a lot of this could be based on past experience. So look back over the last couple of years, including the pandemic, and say, okay, how did canceling a meeting affect us? And what if that were to happen in the future? Is it likely that our insurance company is going to cover event cancellation again? And I would say probably not. A lot of these insurance companies got, you know, taken a bath for dealing with a lot of the event cancellations over the pandemic. So it might be something to think about is if you have another pandemic, you know, and your event gets canceled, then how is that going to affect your reserves? And what's the probability that that's going to happen? So you kind of build that into your calculation. So these are just some examples of risks. The first three of the risks and the bottom two are opportunities. I'm going to just check in the chat here and see if there's any, nope, no questions. Okay. All right. Oh, and sorry, Nathan, thank you. Just real quick, if you have a reserve target of 9.1 million, and like this example says, then what's your reserve ratio? Because that's like a KPI or a key performance indicator that a lot of people look at is a reserve ratio. So your reserve ratio would be determined by your reserve number over your total operating expenses. And in an example kind of scenario, if we had a $30 million budget for operating expenses and a $9.1 million reserve target, our reserve ratio would be 30%. So just kind of giving you that, you know, grounding on that. So we can move forward. I'm letting Nathan move my slides because I am having trouble with it for some reason. So develop your written policy. So once you have figured out your number for your reserves and you've gotten everybody to agree on those risks and opportunities, then you need to develop a written policy. And from the polling question, it sounds like a lot of you have a written policy for reserves already. So you're already, you know, trying to reach a goal or a target for your reserves. And that's great. So, you know, for those of you that don't have a written policy, that's an important step, is to make sure that's written, because then, you know, you've got the buy-in from your board of directors on where you want to go. And then I would also suggest that you periodically review and refresh your reserves target and your reserves policy. So don't let it sit around for, you know, 3-5 years without doing a refresh. I think that's an important step to kind of keep in mind. And then, as I mentioned earlier, taking a look also at your investment policy to make sure that it's addressing how you want to invest the assets that are underlying that reserves target. Okay. Finally, determining a reserves target is an art. I know, like I mentioned earlier, a lot of accountants like the black and white right answer. But with this particular project, it's not going to be like that. It's going to be a lot of communication among stakeholders. It's going to be a lot of educated guesses. It's like budgeting. You know, budgeting is very, you know, you base it on prior year and what you think is going to happen in the future. It's very much like budgeting. So it's an art. And there's no precise method to calculate your reserves. Like the example I provided in my slides here is just one way to do it. It's not the end all be all way to do it. You can get creative and figure it out. But I think if you're listing them out and you're assigning numbers, then it's really easy to then come to your board or your whoever your stakeholders are and say, okay, we have this reason or this bucket of reasons why we have this number in our reserve policy for our target for reserves. And then it becomes a much more defensible amount. So that is, I think, the end of my slide. So I can turn it over. Do we want to try to go back to Melissa?
I think so. Yeah, just because I think there's a natural kind of synergy between your slides and Melissa. So let's try Melissa.
Hey, again. You guys can hear me all right?
Yeah, I think it sounds good, Melissa, at least for now.
Okay, great. Okay, well, all right. So enterprise risk management, I think you guys kind of got some insight already into why that's so important. So we can go ahead and go on to the next slide. So obviously we know the world is totally crazy. There's a lot going on and it's like, okay, well, I saw Susan's list, but like, what do we focus on? How do we know where to focus? And so if I were to sit down with your board or maybe your leadership, and I asked you, what are your three strategic objectives for the year? I guarantee everyone is probably going to see the same thing. They're going to be on board with each other. So if I were to interview your board or management and I say, you know, okay, what do you think your top 3 to 5 risks are? Maybe I interviewed someone else and someone else. I guarantee you it's probably everyone's going to have different opinions. And that's a problem, right? So how do we get to where, you know, Susan's at, or where we can actually strategically reserve for risks? And that's where enterprise risk management comes in. It helps you come up with a methodology to assess what your risks are. So really similar to how you have a methodology with coming up with your strategy, you have a methodology for figuring out, okay, what are our top risks? And do we have agreement and consensus on this? And so if we do, then that should then affect our budgeting and the decisions making that we go forth in. And that's why enterprise risk management is on the rise. And it's critically important for your board to be informed of the top risks. Those can go into the minutes, because now if a cybersecurity event or something happens and you don't have those discussions at the board level, it's also somewhat of a legal problem as well, because the board is responsible for risk oversight. So this kind of information is critical. So the next slide. So this is just a view of what traditional risk management is, and there's nothing wrong with traditional risk management. It's all siloed based, and those folks can continue to go through and do what they do. And so what enterprise risk management does is it sits on top of that, and you go through an exercise on how to figure out, okay, of all these, you know, where are there overlapping risks? Where are there overlapping mitigations? And then those is what gets reported up through management and the board. It's a way to kind of, it's like an enterprise view of everything. Next slide. So the other interesting issue, and this is from NC State. We partner with NC State. We do a lot of really wonderful events, and we did this really cool exercise. And so basically, you know, it's, you know, going through what is significant. Let's interview some folks, right? Let's pretend we're doing this at your association. And maybe we meet with your, you know, your chief information officer. And he says there's 17 significant risks. And the CFO says there's one. And the board says there's zero. And so, like, who's correct, right? Maybe the board's not getting any risk information. That was my first concern, and we need to fix that. But the problem isn't, you know, they're probably all right in their own way, but the problem is they're defining what is significant differently. And so we're not even speaking the same language. And so that's, again, where enterprise risk management comes in. We have maybe an ERM playbook, and it actually defines what is significant to us. And so when I say something significant and needs attention and maybe needs a reserve, you know, that's defined by some sort of methodology. So when I say there's a methodology, that's kind of what we're getting at, is saying, you know, what is significant, the likelihood and impact of something happening, what would be significant or catastrophic? And that's why ERM is important. So basically ERM sits between strategy and risk management. It's right there in the middle. And there you see those threats and opportunities right in there. So what are the risks to us achieving our strategy? And then what are some opportunities there? And so that what lies in the middle is what Susan was referring to in her slides. So going on to the next slide. All right, so how do we even figure this out, right? What are some different ways besides kind of, you know, collecting 1,000 risks from all the different silos, right? And you have this huge risk register and it's too overwhelming, right? But what are some different ways to identify those risks? And one of my favorite ways is objective-based, like sitting down and just talking with folks. What's your strategy for the year? What are you trying to achieve? And what are the risks of you achieving those? You know, what are some past events that have happened? Has there been a cybersecurity event, or maybe COVID's happened, or some events have been canceled in the past? Or let's say we kind of know what our top three risks are. Let's start running through scenarios so that we can kind of figure out what we are going to need in our reserves. So these are just a lot of different examples of some different ways to identify risks. And going to the next slide. And this is another view. This is the objectives-based view that I really like to look at. And so really, I mean, to me, strategy and risk are completely interrelated. When you're doing your strategic plan, you're supposed to do SWOT analysis. You know, you're supposed to look at your strengths, your weaknesses, your opportunities, and your threats. So they really are interrelated. So if you're going to do ERM, I strongly suggest you do it at the same time if you're strategic planning, so that these processes are running parallel. But here you can see that risk number 4, and I can only guess it's probably talent management or some sort of digital transformation, but it's affecting all of our strategic initiatives. We may need to take a closer look at that. And strategic initiative 1 is in a lot of danger. Maybe we need to take a look at that as well, but it really helps provide some insights. And so this is the objective-based view, which is one of my favorite ways to look at it, because you're really not going to see that with traditional risk management, which is typically in silos. And so you can see really quick here, the benefit of looking at this from an ERM lens. And this last slide here, and this is my last slide, and this is basically a white paper that Sue, go ahead to the next page. Susan and I wrote a wonderful white paper for you all, so you can find it on our website. Here's the link. You can connect with us on LinkedIn. Joe Pugh also co-authored this with us, so if you'd like to learn more about enterprise risk management, take a look at this white paper. We love to talk about risks. So I'm going to turn this back over to Yev. Thank you guys for letting me share. Sorry, I had some mic issues to begin with.
Great. And we're actually going over to John for our next polling question, I think.
Oh, we'll get there. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us today. My name is John Pace. I'm a partner in our outsourced accounting and advisory services group. We'll take a look at reserves from a viewpoint of working with many clients on outsourced accounting, but let's get started with this poll. And we got the poll up there. Happy that the kids are back in school. Y'all, a couple seconds. Let's just, I think we can move on, Nathan. The slides are stuck, Nathan. All right, so let's jump right in. Susan's presentation before Melissa included a slide on reserves being an art as well as a science, which is a good transition for us to jump into some basic considerations and financial calculations that will help your organization develop your reserve policy. So starting with some basic definitions, and how we look at your data as part of this process. One thing is to do is to keep in mind that policy should evolve with your organization. The policy that you set today should be reevaluated on a regular basis to make sure it still fits your organization's needs. Depending on where your organization is in its life cycle and the overall economic conditions will determine the frequency at which you review your policy. So that keep that in mind. And so let's jump into basic principles that'll help us set the ground rules. Principle number one, revenue less expenses equals net surplus. This is also referred to as net income or change in net assets, and hopefully this result is positive for you. Principle number two, net surplus doesn't necessarily equal reserves. Just because you have a surplus doesn't mean there are enough funds to establish a reserve. We'll discuss this in greater detail shortly. Principle number three, as net surpluses increase, the potential for reserves also increases. This one's straightforward, but it still needs to be said. More surplus gives you more reserve flexibility. So let's jump to the next slide. Okay, so next we're going to talk about your reserve maximization framework. Most often we start with historical costs and analyze them from there. Could you go back two slides, please? How much history we analyze depends on the specifics of your organization and where you are in your business life cycle. So if your historical costs aren't stable or not indicative of where your organization is headed, consider creating a forecast. Now, generally speaking, I like to forecast a year or two at most. If your organization has a good strategic plan, perhaps we can forecast out a little bit further. So some questions we want to ask is, do your revenue sources currently cover your historical and forecasted costs? Is there an opportunity for you to control some of your costs? Determine your key cost drivers. So now, the next thing we want to do is analyze your revenue sources. Is it possible to diversify your revenue? Yevgeny will take a look at this topic in greater detail shortly, but typical association revenue sources include things such as dues, events, publications, and there may be some opportunity to get creative with your revenue sources. You can try to focus on those opportunities with higher gross profit percentage. So let's move to the next slide. And we're gonna jump into try and go ahead and set a policy. So remember, go back to the art versus science comment on reserves. In our experience, no two organizations are quite alike. Therefore, if you start with nothing else and assuming that you have a net surplus and some liquid cash, I would start your reserve policy considering between 3 to 6 months of average historical operating expenses. Your mileage may vary, of course, but you can always add to your reserves and update your policy as time goes on. I would say that the majority of our clients fall into utilizing 3 to 6 months of operating expenses as a target for reserves, but I've also seen examples of clients with a fair amount of cash that build their reserves on the order of 12 to 18 months. We also have some clients that are not yet in a position to build operating reserves because of where they are in their life cycle and potential challenges that they might face. So I think a key thing to remember is your policy doesn't have to be perfect. I think it's a good idea to get started and adjust as you need to. Perfection can be the enemy of progress. So jump right in and get started on calculating your reserves and analyzing. And so next, Yevgeny's going to take a deeper look into cost and revenue analysis. So I'll turn it over to Yevgeny.
Perfect. Thanks, John. And just turning on my video here. Okay, so as John and really everybody before John, Susan, and Melissa alluded to, this is probably more all, I would say, more of an art than a science. So some of what I'm going to kind of share is obviously not to meant to be prescriptive by any nature, that this is all for educational purposes, as we alluded to at the beginning, but just some things to consider when you're doing that cost analysis that John was referring to earlier, at least in our experience in dealing with our clients. We try to kind of segment that cost analysis into two, what we call buckets. So more of the historical cost analysis, just looking at the trends in your past years of operations. And then the second bucket being that more of a forecast or a projection of your cost, most likely using some of those historical trends and projecting them forward, but also accounting and keeping in mind some of your strategic initiatives for your association for the future. So with respect to that historical cost analysis, just some things to keep in mind as far as, if nothing else, I would call it probably data integrity. So you want to be careful about factoring in and projecting out any such cyclicality or maybe one-off cost that you may have in your previous years that may not continue to occur in the future. So when we think about cyclicality, it could be things like, again, for a lot of associations, a big primary revenue driver could be like an annual event. It could be the renewal of certain members, some of the bigger members, and all the costs associated with getting those members renewed smoothly. It could be something like perhaps an annual publication and magazine, all the costs associated with getting that produced and out into the public. Again, there's a little bit of cyclicality to all of those events. So making sure you account for that and realize that in going forward, you will likely have similar cyclicality or at least be aware that it's there. And then similar to extend out that concept, when we think about just some of those non-recurring one-off costs, you can kind of break them down. What I'm doing here is breaking them down into three sub-buckets, if you will. So if you think about capital versus operating costs are those that are more, I would say, consistent in nature, recurring, those true costs to operate and provide the services that you do. Whereas the capital costs are those that you likely will not be having every 2 to 3 years, but it could be things like, again, investment to technology, perhaps a new AMS system, maybe a member database management system, maybe just generally investments into training materials and certifications and maybe redesigning your website. So again, those are unlikely to occur every year. So just be aware of those when you're looking at your historical costs. And then maybe some examples of just one-off non-recurring costs that are not necessarily capital in nature. Those could be things like maybe some litigation that unfortunately you had to go through or some legal costs that hopefully will not reappear. Or perhaps maybe now with a lot of association, a lot of organization in general going back into the office, maybe you are now relocating to an office space because you found cheaper space. And so that's probably going to be a one-time cost. And then the third bucket that I mentioned as far as those kind of broader category of one-off costs is going to be more of the strategic initiative. So sometimes it can be confused with capital costs, but examples of these could be like, again, investment into technology, perhaps expanding your annual event or enhancing it in some way, maybe developing some kind of new programming, something like that. So just be aware of that and that the frequency of them and the nature of their recurrence in thinking about your future projection and what your cost composition will look like. And as far as your forecast, I think Melissa and Susan kind of already alluded to this earlier, but just keep in mind of the assumptions that you have in your forecast and your projection, which I would kind of term more of your internal assumptions. And then you have your external market conditions. So on the internal assumption side, maybe what are you projecting your membership growth to be? And what are your staffing needs have to be alongside to accommodate that kind of growth? So what are your staffing costs going to be to accommodate what kind of membership structure and how many members you're going to project out into the future? Maybe just generally speaking, technology costs to accommodate that membership growth. And then on the external side, the biggest one that comes to mind, obviously, is what's happening in the economy, the unemployment rate, the inflation rate, all of that, what generally is happening in the labor market. And then nowadays, with everything happening with technology and artificial intelligence, what impact is that going to have on your cost composition, potential cost savings there? And I won't speak to this much, but everything that Melissa and Susan shared earlier, as far as the risk considerations of that forecast, that's where likely that kind of risk-based weighted approach will come into play. And the same general principles of assigning probabilities will factor in well in terms of your forecast of costs. So moving forward, switching gears a little bit, in terms of just things to consider as far as revenue diversification strategy, some of what we're experiencing in the outsourcing practice of GRF, at least in our clients. So some of them are considering a different structure to their pricing for memberships dues. And a lot of them are considering tiered pricing, perhaps some element of like a la carte pricing, if you will. So the members can kind of choose the specific benefits, and that tends to accommodate more flexibility in the pricing and oftentimes leads to higher revenues than previously. So the other thing that we're seeing, not as frequent, but it's something to kind of keep in mind, perhaps forming partnerships with some accreditation bodies to offer continuing education courses for a fee. If you already have a lot of that educational content, just consider that to be another potential revenue source. And then also, especially with everything happening with artificial intelligence and its data analysis abilities, perhaps gleaning some insights from everything that's happening within your membership organizations and anonymizing that data to hopefully offer some kind of insights to your members and just generally in the form of educational content that you can then structure and package as more like consultative services in their way of like strategic planning, compliance, operational efficiencies, so on and so forth. So again, these are just some examples to think about. A lot of this will be very particular to your organization, but these are some of the ones that we're finding to have more prominence. And so finally, on the cost containment side, if we just go to the next slide. Yep, here. So again, it's going to be very particular to our organization, but some of the ones that we're finding to be most impactful across our client base is performing operational efficiency reviews, kind of those assessments of your procedures and your systems to see if there's any ways that you can introduce automation or just more generally make them more efficient, all with the goal of hopefully reducing your overhead costs, maximizing your use of in-kind contributions. So again, volunteers, maybe some kind of in-kind rent, other in-kind services. The biggest one probably that we're seeing across the board is outsourcing what we kind of call non-core functions. So those functions that perhaps are going to be least impactful on the general membership and member experience. So things that immediately come to mind, obviously IT, accounting, perhaps management of the data of the membership database system and the data entry surrounding it, content writing, social media management is another big one that we see. And then it goes without saying, every hopefully 2 to 3 years, reviewing your vendor contracts to ensure that you're still getting the most competitive pricing that you can get out there. And then from the perspective of financial management more generally, we, to the extent possible, we know it's quite burdensome, but promote the idea of zero-based budgeting. So really just starting each budget cycle from scratch, not just rolling forward the prior year's budget with all the underlying assumptions. Really hold the budget owners accountable to their budget, really thinking through their operations, what they need for the success of their specific budget, and then introducing and kind of monitoring that with ongoing monthly budget versus actual reports. And again, sharing those with the budget owners and having the regular meetings to discuss what's going on with the budget. Why are we over here? Why are we under here? So all with the goal of general accountability toward the budget. So with that, I will turn it over to Tricia, hopefully for some more practical application experience with everything we discussed so far.
I'm trying to get my video on, so bear with me. We seem to be having some technical difficulties with Zoom today. But I do have with me today, my name is Tricia Catabini, just so everyone knows, partner in the audit department. I do have with me today Mike Johnson, who is the president and CEO of the National Stone, Sand, and Gravel Association, as Yevgeny mentioned earlier. And we wanted to bring an association leader on with us today simply because, you know, we are the experts from an external perspective, but being able to really collaborate and talk with a true leader in the association space, someone that does lead an actual organization, is obviously of great value from our perspective. So Mike, I wanted to bring you on first and foremost. Thank you so much for joining us today. I know you cannot unfortunately join us via video because you are also experiencing some of these difficulties. So why don't you just give us a little introduction about yourself, as well as the National Stone, Sand, and Gravel Association.
Absolutely, Tricia, and thanks for the invitation today. For all the participants in the webinar, the technical difficulties have given you a bit of a gift today. For those of you who don't know me, I have a face made for radio, so you're getting it the best possible way today. But let's talk about NSSGA for a second. We're about a $13 million trade association. We represent producers and what we call manufacturer and service division providers who extract aggregates from the earth and then turn those into building materials. We like to say that rocks build America, and at NSSGA, advocacy to that point is job one. So for us, we are first and foremost the trade association that advocates for the members of our industry. I've been the CEO here now just over 11 years, and got to tell you, it's a fantastic group to work for, and it's a very strong association.
Thanks for that introduction, Mike, to yourself as well as to the association. So I know that you've been a client of mine for, I believe, 4 or 5 years at this point now. So I've seen you all kind of grow. I've seen you take some steps back. I've seen you continue to kind of move forward from those paces as well. So, you know, you have a very interesting story from my perspective when it comes to the association, how you've kind of managed the reserves and also kind of reinvested back into the organization as whole. So when we think through that, you know, I kind of want to give a little bit of that story and kind of where you started that process with the reserves, you know, how you really talked through this process of the reinvestment for the growth of the organization for the future, from a governance standpoint, and then where you all are currently here in this process. And for the attendees today, you know, really being mindful that this is a time and space for Q&A, because again, you've got one of the top of the minds from the association world leaders. So if you have any questions that you might want to ask Mike as well, please feel free to throw those into the Q&A chat. But Mike, I'll throw it out to you again to kind of give us some of that background story on the reserves and kind of how you've been reinvesting back into the organization.
Yeah, thanks, Tricia. And look, it's incredibly important, as you've heard from the other speakers today, to set a reserve policy and then to strive to fund your reserves to meet that policy. When I joined this organization, our reserve policy settled on the fact that they wanted to have 1 year of average operating in reserve. And we had that when I started here. As we went through the time that I was here in the early days and through the pandemic, we really wondered, why do we have a year? And if we really ever need a year of operating reserves, what's the point of continuing to have the association? That would mean that our members have stopped paying dues, that our meetings have all been canceled. You know, what would we be here for? So we started to kind of rethink it. And then the pandemic helped put that on steroids for us. Just to give you a little color, we were the last meeting and trade show in Las Vegas in March of 2020 before that town shut down due to the pandemic. We went through some major changes to our meeting. We went forward with an in-person that week, but we also did a hybrid, which put us on, frankly, maybe the cutting edge of changing the way we would meet for the next year. But we took a serious financial hit by changing the format of that meeting. We couldn't imagine a day that would be any any rainier from a rainy day perspective than that was or that period was for the association. And what we found was that the reserves we had were well more than enough to carry us through that. Mm-hmm. So our officers and I sat down and started talking about how do we move forward from here, and we changed our policy. We changed our policy to go to what ASAE, American Society for Association Executives, says is essentially the gold standard, and that's 6 months of annual operating in reserve. So we started looking at what are opportunities to use that money to reinvest in the business of the association and grow in terms of what we could provide our members in terms of benefits or effectiveness in advocacy. Really quickly, we started looking at our member engagement. We figured out that our own governance system was getting in the way of our members engaging the way we wanted them to. We started to look at consolidation in our industry, and we realized that we were losing about $200,000 a year to consolidation of members, mostly due to purchases by another member company. So we set to change our governance and, as part of that, our dues formula to account for that consolidation. Rather than losing any of our smaller members who might find a change in the dues formula too expensive for them, we decided to roll it in over 5 years. And we did that by financing the rollout of the new dues formula, or the phase in, over 5 years with reserve spend. Now it's important to point out that in the sixth and seventh year of the phase in, we actually moved back into positive reserve growth. But being able to reinvest some of that reserve balance in the association was crucial. The second thing we did was we decided to take a look at our database. It wasn't serving our needs. And we found out that there were options that would better serve our needs, but it would take a fairly significant investment. The officers and the executive committee approved, again, a reserve spend to build a new database for the organization. And as we look at the out years, we've got a plan for recovering those expenses and, again, starting to grow reserves back to that point where we will maintain 6 months in the bank. But, you know, I think it's really important. And some of the things I hear from my colleagues that have, frankly, a year or more in reserve is their members start asking, why do we have it? Why do we have so much? And they come up with ideas for how to use it, like dues holidays. And let me just tell you, I think, and if you talk to a lot of folks at ASAE or at a nonprofit organization, they will tell you that dues holidays are rarely, if ever, a good idea, because once you discount the value of the association, how do you ever get that back? So for us, we decided dues holidays weren't the way we would go. We'd instead invest in the business.
That's all very useful and helpful information. I love the backstory that you put in there. So as you all were kind of talking through your reserve mix and getting to that 6 month now ratio that you really wanted to get to versus that 1 year that you did have, what were some of the risks that were kind of going through your mind as the president and CEO, maybe even the board from their perspective? And then did any of the members kind of push back as you thought through your new structure to kind of bring that reserve back up?
You know, when we were able to really paint a picture for our leadership and frankly, the membership in general of how we intended to use the reserve spend to grow the association, to grow our capabilities, to be their primary federal trade association, and to represent their interests better, when we were able to tell a story about how using those reserve dollars would improve our ability to be effective for them, it really resonated. And we did it by essentially writing a business plan for how we would use the money and what it would turn into in terms of benefit for the members of the association on the things that they told us that were most important to them. We put it into our strategic plan. And it is a piece of our 3-year strategic plan to utilize the reserves in the way that we have. So by really mapping it out, by explaining it carefully, by clearly painting that picture of how the members would benefit, it really got in front of any of the concerns you might hear otherwise. If anybody looked at the books and saw reserve spend or deficit budget without that context, it might bring up questions that would cause them to reconsider whether or not the association is on the right path. By getting in front of it, all of our members understood exactly what we were doing, why we were doing it, and what the end game looked like, and when we would start to return money to the reserves. So we've been lucky. We've been able to control our expenses well. We've had better than expected revenue. And we're going to end the five-year implementation of the new due formula and the purchase of the new database with lower deficits than we expected and be back to reserve growth much faster than we had anticipated. So, you know, I tell people all the time, on any given day, I'd rather be lucky than good. So we were good, but we got a little bit lucky too. And that helped the membership really trust in the process and not doubt that we were doing the right thing. And when they started seeing the results of the investment, that just made it crystal clear that it was the right call for the association.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess when it comes to the reserves, because I'm sure that we have, you know, different varying levels of association reserves on this webinar for today. You know, one of the big questions in the back of my mind is, at what point would you or did you feel confident enough to be able to reinvest back into the organization? And I guess really my question is stemming from, for instance, you had that 1 year reserve already in play. If you only had 6 months, would you kind of backtrack a little bit and try to build that up and then reinvest at that point? Or would you have just kind of curtailed and done a different kind of strategic plan to be able to do the things that you wanted to do? And I'm only speaking that because, again, we have different reserve levels, but also different timelines of how mature some of these associations might be on our webinar today.
Yeah, Tricia, if we hadn't had the 1 year in reserve, I wouldn't have been comfortable going to the 6 months. And let me play that out a little bit further and say, if we hadn't been in a position where we yet had 6 months, I would have focused on building 6 months of reserves before I had even considered suggesting using any of that money to invest in anything other than a strong reserve. It's critical that you have that rainy day fund.
Yeah.
We likely will experience some disruption again to the business model, whether it's another pandemic or some other eventuality. Someday we're all going to be challenged again in the marketplace. And having that 6 months of reserves to lean on to make sure that you don't lose the ability to continue to be effective for your members, to continue to deliver on the value that they pay the dues for, critically important. So I think the 6 months is the magic number for us. That's what our folks got comfortable with. Again,
yeah,
we didn't base it off any rocket science. We looked at the ASAE recommendations and followed that. And so having more than that was what enabled us to get creative in investing and growing the business. But yeah, for everybody out there, focus first on getting the 6 months. If you happen to do really well in that, or your reserves start to kick off excess returns, or your surpluses continue to grow because you're just great managers or your revenue's coming in stronger than expected, then it frees you up to look at what you might be able to do to really take the association to the next level and serving the members.
Yeah, and I think you're saying something very important and you're saying it very subtly. And we've had some questions surrounding that during the course of the webinar, just about what level of reserves should an association have. And you know, specifically said for us it's 6 months, but for another type of association, depending on customer base, depending on where you are geographically, what other products you may offer out to your memberships, you know, it may look different. And that's really important in terms of making sure that you have those policies in place, that you've done the heat map or the risk assessment that Melissa spoke about. You know, so every organization may look a little bit different when it comes to those reserves. You know, I'm very interested to hear from you, though. You know, you mentioned you all got lucky. Is there anything that you have learned through this process or anything that you would do differently now, having some of this hindsight over the past, I think it's been what, 2 years, 2.5 years or so, maybe three, since I kind of work in the past with my work? You know, is there anything you would have done differently?
Yeah, so I'll get to that, but let me go back to something you said that I think is very important, and that is you gotta know your business, and you have to know how you're situated as an association. For us, most of our revenue comes from dues. So about 70% of the revenue of the National Stone Sand and Gravel Association comes from member dues. So when we are looking at the business environment we're in, if we aren't seeing attrition in membership, if we aren't seeing drops in dues, then, you know, our revenue is coming in at a strong enough point that we can be a little more bold in spending our reserves. When you think about a pandemic, things like that, that might impact your meetings, your events, your other business offerings, and there's some associations that offer standard setting and other certification programs as a key piece of their revenue. You have to fully understand your revenue model and how it would be affected by anything that might come along that would interrupt it. Mm-hmm. For us, by being a dues heavy revenue model, it really, the member satisfaction ratings we were seeing, the renewals we were seeing, the increase in member dues made it more comfortable to spend reserves. But you're absolutely right. You have to understand your association and where you are in your business model, what your risks are, before you can get comfortable in that reserve spend space. So on that, just wanted to reiterate what you just said. But, you know, in terms of what I would do differently, I got to be honest, we have had such a positive experience in the way that we have done this. I haven't really learned a lot that I would do differently, but what I have learned that I would absolutely do again is openly and honestly communicate with your membership. You know, your members have day jobs. They have businesses they run or practices that they're engaged in. You have to be completely conversant with them and make sure that they understand what we as association professionals may understand about our business that wouldn't come to them naturally. And things like that standard for acceptable reserves or a gold standard for reserves and a reserve policy. You know, that's something that in their daily business practice, they may not think about or may not understand. Communicating with them, bringing them into that loop, making it part of your strategic planning exercises to have that reserve policy be part of your long-term plan for the business of the association really makes all of the decisions about should we continue to grow, should we spend, are we comfortable, do we need to be more aggressive in trying to generate money surpluses to grow the reserves. Having those conversations, it's much easier if you brought your members along every step of the way in the way that you communicate with them and talk about the business of the association.
Yeah. All great points. Well, Mike, I think that puts us right at noon. So I want to say thank you very much for your time that you've given to us today. I think that you have given us a very good perspective, well-rounded perspective on just kind of your story and SGA's story. So thank you again for joining us. Yev, I'll turn it back to you to kind of close us out here.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you so much, Mike and Tricia. That was super, super impactful, insightful. And yeah, so we're right on time. And just with that, we want to thank you all for joining us today. We encourage you all to follow us on social media at GRF CPAs and visit our websites for all of our upcoming events, alerts, anything like that. Please also remember to complete the survey that's going to follow. I know we had some technical difficulties, so we work with all of you to ensure you get the CPE credit that you need. And thank you all once again and have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the GRF On The Go podcast. Visit our website at grfcpa.com for more information about the services we provide, the industries we serve, or to request a quote.